From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Wednesday, the 12 members of the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction failed to reach an agreement in advance of their Thanksgiving week deadline. The so-called supercommittee of six Republicans and six Democrats was created last summer to cut the deficit by more than $1 trillion. It had just a few months to get the job done, or else automatic cuts would be triggered, including a big chunk out of the Pentagon's budget. Most of the media saw the inability to reach an agreement as a colossal failure.
Well, if President Obama thought that by avoiding being directly involved in the supercommittee's negotiations, he would avoid being blamed for any super fail, well, he was wrong.
The deficit supercommittee ended in a super failure.
The supercommittee's super failure leaves the country facing more than $1 trillion in painful across-the-board cuts.
I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. Congress insults the American people. That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. It's really embarrassing, really embarrassing.
But according to New York Magazine politics writer Jonathan Chait, the supercommittee was not a failure at all. It successfully accomplished, he says, exactly what it was created for,
which was get us out of the debt ceiling crisis. We were stuck in a Cuban Missile Crisis situation. The supercommittee was the way out. If the committee didn't report back with its $1.2 trillion in deficit cuts, cuts would automatically take place. But they wouldn't take place until 2013. So the timing of this, I think, was very cleverly constructed to just delay everything and make the Tea Party kind of forget about the debt ceiling. And it worked. No one's talking about the debt ceiling, and we're going to get through the election without risking economic chaos.
The narrative in most of the press is that this was, in fact, a tremendous failure to come up with a solution that both parties could stomach. You say it was never about that at all. Are you saying that what we've just witnessed is 6 months of political theater?
It is, in the sense that there was never going to be a bipartisan agreement to cut the deficit. It's just too contrary to the ideology of the Republican Party. They're interested in cutting spending and they're interested in cutting taxes. They'll use the deficit as a kind of rhetorical device to try to create pressure for a solution that does those things. But they're not going to agree to something that creates any kind of balanced deficit reduction proposal between taxes and spending, because that's just not what they want.
If you're right, no compromise was possible from the very outset, and therefore the story has been misreported. Is it as simple as that?
It is as simple as that. I think the story has been misreported. You have to have neutral reporting. So to me, the neutral thing to do would be to say, we're not going to take a position on whether reducing the deficit is really important, but we will describe the positions of the two parties. And the positions are the Democrats are willing to do a kind of balanced solution between cutting entitlement programs that they'd rather not cut in return for higher revenue, and the Republicans are not willing to accept a compromise like that. Instead, the media has all very heavily leapt on the bandwagon of we need to cut the deficit. They treat this as an obvious truth. So because they're openly rooting for cutting the deficit, in order to come out with a balanced picture at the end, they have to paint it like both sides are equally to blame. And this has happened through commission after commission and process after process and negotiation after negotiation. There's simply been no way to budge the Republican Party off this stance. There's this persistent denial you've seen in the news media. They simply won't allow themselves to accept what they're actually saying.
As Thanksgiving approached, the press ran sort of a doomsday clock on the supercommittee. And if they continued to be deadlocked and failed to act and these automatic cuts were triggered, more than $1 trillion, you know, you got the notion that we were going to have to ground the Air Force and call the ships into harbor. So severe was the automatic trigger. Was that irresponsible in the end?
Yes, that was irresponsible. There are two problems with the media's hysteria on this question. Number one, the supercommittee was not really designed to reduce the deficit. The supercommittee was designed to get us out of the debt ceiling crisis. Number two, the trigger for the supercommittee doesn't actually take place until 2013, when we also have the expiration of the Bush tax cuts. So what we really have is a big setup for some kind of fiscal reckoning in 2013, which will be triggered by the results of the 2012 elections. So nothing really happens with the failure of the supercommittee, and nothing can really be expected to happen until the elections are over.
Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Chait is a writer for New York Magazine.
It turns out that political intransigence is by no means confined to Capitol Hill. Consider the study economics professor Daniel B. Klein conducted in 2010 that found that conservatives knew more about economic policy than liberals. Klein wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal. Right-wing media outlets were thrilled. Left-wing ones cried bias. Was his study biased? Well, for his survey, Klein asked liberals and conservatives to agree or disagree with 8 economic policy statements from a previous study intended to measure something else. It just so happened that some of those statements implicitly challenged liberal assumptions, while none of them challenged conservative beliefs. So Klein and his colleague ran a second study, this time with statements implicitly challenging positions held by the right. That study found that right-wingers are just as resistant to inconvenient truths as lefties. Let's start with an example from Klein's first survey, the one with statements that challenged liberal dogmas. Quote, "A company with the largest market share is a monopoly." That's simply false, but Klein found that liberals and progressives were far more likely than conservatives and libertarians to agree with that statement.
That was one of the 4 questions, 4 of the 8 used, which I thought were not ideological. And that's one reason that I had confidence that these results were telling us something real. The progressives and liberals did quite much worse on that question. And I thought, this is just the definition of monopoly. We thought we were seeing, yeah, there's some that are clearly challenging the left, but there's some that we thought did not. And because even on those, the progressives and liberals did noticeably worse, we thought we were picking up something real. Folks on the left were extremely upset. They said the questions were biased and skewed. I thought that I was acting more or less responsibly.
What pushed you to do a second study if you were quite comfortable with the questions you'd originally offered and your assumption that they were non-ideological?
Honestly, I'm not sure how much it was a balance of the following 2 things. One of them is, well, we're getting a tremendous amount of pushback on this, and maybe they're right, and we ought to really see what happens when you turn the questions against the conservatives and libertarians. On the other hand, there's no question that I was doing it hoping that the conservatives and libertarians, especially the libertarians, because that's my side, would do well in the face of questions that were inconvenient for them. I was hoping to vindicate what we'd done by showing that, okay, here, now I've turned it around, I've made it sort of equal or symmetric, and look, the left still does a lot worse.
So you asked a new set of questions.
We created 9 new questions, and all of them challenge conservative and or libertarian positions.
One of the questions, for instance, was, gun laws fail to reduce people's access to guns. The wrong answer to that, the answer favored by the right, was yes. They agreed with the proposition that gun laws fail to limit access to guns. Which question bothered you the most?
Drug prohibition fails to reduce people's access to drugs. 89% of libertarians agreed that drug prohibition fails to reduce people's access to drugs, which is a very convenient thing to believe if you're going to oppose drug prohibition, as libertarians do. An overly convenient thing. I think it's clear that drug prohibition reduces people's access to drugs.
I was particularly interested in the question involving the value of a dollar.
Yeah, that's created a great deal of controversy. Even some of my libertarian economist colleagues have been challenging me on that. The question is, a dollar means more to a poor person than it does to a rich person. I think it's clearly true that a dollar means more to a poor person than it does to a rich person. But the very conservatives got this wrong almost 44% of the time, and the libertarians almost 31% of the time, whereas the progressives got this wrong only 4% of the time. So they did much, much better. The left did much, much better on this question.
So obviously the crucial finding in the second study isn't that it proved that people on the left were any smarter. They weren't. Only that everyone suffers from what you call my side bias, or what psychologists call confirmation bias. You want to give us a little clearer explanation of how that manifests itself?
people embracing statements that make defending their position simpler. You know, if someone who opposes the welfare state admits that a dollar means more to a poor person than it does to a rich person, that makes it harder for them to defend their position.
To quote from your piece, a full tabulation of all 17 questions found that no group clearly outstupids the other. They appear about equally stupid when faced with proper challenges to their positions.
I mean, the way I sort of pounced on the left when I had the first study, sort of the high confidence I had at that time, I think you could to some extent call my side or confirmation bias.
So after the first study, you wrote that, quote, governmental power joined with wrongheadedness is something terrible but all too common. Realizing that many of our leaders and their constituents are economically unenlightened sheds light on the troubles that surround us. Do you still feel that way?
I do. I do. And in a way, widespread my side bias shows how difficult intelligent deliberation is going to be in a governmentalized system. You're going to get, I think, more this problem, which is pervasive, is going to have larger effects.
So you have drawn from these two studies and the fact that everyone outstupids everyone else, that government just isn't workable. Spoken like a true libertarian.
There you go. But I mean, I'm actually serious about that.
Oh, I know.
But I mean, I think there's some sense in that.
Let's say we're all a bunch of apes. Is it better for apes to try and create a government or for them just to run around in the jungle without one?
I'm not sure.
That's a very fair answer. Professor Klein, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Daniel B. Klein is an economics professor at George Mason University. His piece in the December Atlantic is titled, I Was Wrong, and So Are You.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, it was British star Hugh Grant testifying about having his phone hacked by the British tabloid News of the World. Journalists make a big mistake when they hack phones, not just because it's unethical, but because it can undercut the very best reporting. Consider the Cincinnati Inquirer, which 13 years ago conducted a massive probe into the practices of the Cincinnati-based global corporation Chiquita Brands International. After investing a lot of time and money in the project, the Inquirer published a scathing exposé of Chiquita's malpractices, including law-breaking in four countries, bribery, endangering workers, and bulldozing villages. But then it became known that Inquirer reporter Mike Gallagher had broken into Chiquita's voicemail system. The Inquirer fired Gallagher, relocated his editor, agreed to pay Chiquita millions of dollars, apologized repeatedly, and recanted the stories. As the British phone hacking scandal drags on, it's worth recalling that in 1998, the Chiquita case was fast, some might say furiously, settled. As for the reaction to Chiquita's wide-ranging illegalities and corruption, mostly there wasn't any. Ethicist Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute has used the Cincinnati Inquirer saga in classes as an object lesson.
The lesson is when your methods for gathering information are dishonest, the information you gather is suspect, and that case is the perfect lesson in that no one has challenged the findings of the newspaper, yet nobody talks about that as a great investigative piece. They talk about it as an ethical scandal.
But isn't that because the Inquirer renounced its year-long investigation? Did the Inquirer have to do that?
I think they had to do it to avoid further financial damage. They were being sued. We don't know exactly what Chiquita was seeking, but at a certain point, the Inquirer had to cut its losses, and its losses were in the millions. So that's the point at which great journalism gets lost.
But it seemed that the Cincinnati Inquirer had a higher obligation to stand by the story that exposed the unsavory business practices of a leading corporate citizen.
The problem is if someone has a legal knife to your throat, you forego your paper's ability to ever do that again if you can't get out from that civil liability. And it's not, I mean, estimates are that they had to pay somewhere between $10 and $50 million to Chiquita. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not defending the retraction as much as I am
condemning the practice of voicemail hacking.
Exactly. There are so many times when you're tempted to do something that's slightly illegal. Somebody leaves the office when you're interviewing them and their computer screen's open, or somebody gives you a password or tells you how to get to information. And it seems so innocuous when you're gathering thousands and thousands of small pieces of information. But in fact, it can undermine every ounce of credibility that you have.
But when you consider the stakes, Chiquita, at the time that this story was being produced, was paying protection money to death squads in Colombia. These death squads were later designated terrorist groups by the U.S., and Chiquita was ultimately forced to pay $25 million in government fines. Here's what strikes me as really ironic. They had three choices. They could not pay the protection money and see their employees murdered. They could pay the protection money, or they could pack up and move out of Colombia and lose an incredibly rich market. They chose to pay the protection money. It strikes me that this is a kind of an analogy for what the Cincinnati Inquirer did. It paid protection money to Chiquita so that it could continue to operate in Cincinnati, but at the cost of protecting a corporation that was doing genuine harm and causing lives to be lost abroad.
Perhaps. But if you look at all the other reporting that the Inquirer does in Cincinnati, covering the schools, covering government, enabling democracy to happen, one story versus thousands of stories. Because the Cincinnati Inquirer doesn't have the option of leaving Cincinnati.
What about the option of firing Gallagher, admitting his wrongdoing?
Well, I think that had they done that before they published, they would have been in a fairly solid position with both the public and the courts. One of the things about journalism is if you explain things ahead of time, you are in so much of a better position with the audience because you don't come off as defensive or guilty even. They didn't do that before they published. The Inquirer didn't know that thousands of times one of their reporters had listened to personal voicemails of an executive and were then up against a wall and didn't have a lot of options.
So maybe there's the object lesson. People will go astray. But if you're transparent at the beginning with that process, then the reporting will still stand.
Sure. The cliche is to ask forgiveness rather than permission. But in fact, in journalism, if you explain ahead of time to your audience what you did to get the information, the audience generally will back you up.
Kelly, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Journalism ethicist Kelly McBride works at the Poynter Institute. You know, you don't actually need skills to hack into voicemails, because often the people you want to hack make it laughably easy. So as our holiday gift to you, we're rerunning our interview with WNYC's John Keefe, who picked up some tips on how to safeguard your voicemails after he essentially hacked into his own and those of his colleagues.
And just to be clear, we all did it together. I did not break into anybody else's phones unauthorized. Basically, here's the deal. A lot of cell phone companies allow you to check your voicemail from your own phone without a password, right? So if you're somewhere else and you're at somebody else's phone, you need a four-digit code to hear your messages, but not from your own phone. The way that works is that the voicemail system sees your caller ID and goes, oh, that's Brooke. I'm okay with that. here are your voicemails. What I did with the computer is I paid $10 to a service that fakes caller ID numbers. So I put in my own phone number into the computer and then got into my voicemail system. The voicemail system said, oh, John's calling. Here are your voicemail messages.
So this service, you paid $10 in order to have it spoof or fake the caller ID simply by you plugging in somebody's phone number, seems like a clear violation of privacy. This doesn't seem legal.
Well, the spoofing of caller ID numbers in and of itself is not illegal. Under the Truth in Caller ID Act of 2009, it's clearly not legal if you're faking a caller ID with, quote, the intent to defraud, cause harm, or wrongfully obtain anything of value.
Who's to say if a voicemail is of value?
I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure. But it seems to me, if not illegal, definitely unethical.
And what would the legitimate purpose of such a service be?
Maybe you want to make a phone call to somebody and you don't want them to know what your real phone number is. They actually pitch it as a privacy tool, that you can make a phone call without having to reveal your own phone number.
Now, I have a Verizon phone and I always have to put in the 4-digit password.
That's right. And that's true for Verizon phones, actually. A spokesperson told me that. We tried 4 different companies. We tried AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon. And we were able to actually listen to voicemail messages, and again, all voluntarily, of both of the AT&T phones and one of the Sprint phones. We weren't able to listen to the 2 T-Mobile phones that we had or the Verizon accounts either.
The bottom line here is that it's unbelievably easy to hack into anybody's voicemail if they have AT&T or Sprint. Is that not true?
A spokesman for AT&T told me that they have this feature that allows you to access your voicemail from your own phone without a password, and that they strongly encourage that people set their passwords for that. A spokesperson for Sprint said that they, too, offer that option, and they warn their customers that when they're setting up their voicemail, that if they don't add that 4-digit PIN, that it could leave your voicemail vulnerable. I'll tell you that the ease in which I was able to use a computer without a password and without my own phone to hear the voicemail of my wife from the day before was really startling.
Okay, so in this consumer news you can use segment, you offer 3 bits of advice to protect privacy.
That's right. So the first one appears to be that if you add these 4-digit codes to your ability to hear your voicemail, even from your own handset, that is a help. The second thing is that you can delete your voicemail messages, right? If there's nothing to listen to, there's nothing to listen to. If you're not interested in adding that 4-digit code, that's another way to do it. The third thing is that every time we did this little trick, a byproduct of it was that it left a missed call on our phone from our own phone number. If you ever were to get that on your phone, I'd be very suspicious.
Watch out if you appear to have called yourself.
Exactly.
John, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
John Keefe is WNYC's senior executive producer for news.
More than 4 decades before Rupert Murdoch shuttered News of the World, before Entertainment Tonight, long before Perez Hilton, Nikki Fink, and TMZ were serving America's appetite for celebrity scandal, we had Confidential Magazine. Lasting only 6 years, it wasn't our nation's first gossip rag, but when Robert Harrison launched Confidential in 1952, he surely cashed in on the power of celebrity news. Henry E. Scott is author of Shocking True Story, The Rise and Fall of Confidential, America's Most Scandalous Scandal Magazine. The next voice you will hear is me speaking to Scott 2 years ago. Now, when I think of Confidential, I think of Curtis Hanson's movie L.A. Confidential and Danny DeVito with the speed of flex, getting tips from cops and being in places where Hollywood stars were in compromising positions. Is that a fairly good representation of what the real Confidential was doing?
Interestingly enough, Robert Harrison disliked Hollywood and went there only twice in his life. He eventually, however, realized that the sexiest gossip, the gossip that was sending his single copy sales soaring, came out of Hollywood. So he sent his niece and her husband there to set up the Hollywood Research Bureau. The key people they socialized with, rather quietly, were the cops, Fred Otash, who was a former detective with the L.A. Police Department. If you knew a scandal was brewing, you hired Otash right away so that the other side didn't hire him. A wonderful woman named Veronica Quillen, a madam and a prostitute herself, and who was known as Ronnie Quillen, the Soiled Dove. And there was a whole cast of wacky characters put on the confidential payroll. The waiters and bartenders, the jilted lovers who either had an axe to grind or were looking for a cash payment.
In its heyday, what did the magazine look like?
The cover used more exclamation marks than I have ever seen in any single publication anywhere in my life. Red and yellow were the primary colors. And the one thing Harrison loved was alliteration. So when Confidential talked about Robert Gillette, a New York socialite dating a woman who Confidential said was really an African-American woman, it described her as his tawny temptress, his sepia sweetheart.
And what were the biggest scoops?
Life magazine featured Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz, and their two children on the cover as the ideal Hollywood family. Just as Life magazine came out with that beautiful picture on the cover, Confidential came out with a story. The source was Ronnie Quillen, the Soiled Dove, the story about her liaison with Desi Arnaz. It was a perfect example of how Confidential was willing to tell the truth no matter what. Confidential might go back 10 years, 15 years and dig something up out of your past and reveal it at the time that it hurt you most.
One thing that distinguished Confidential from other gossip magazines was that they actually insisted that the stuff be true?
Absolutely. This was one of the smartest things Harrison did. He spent an enormous amount of money on fact-checking. He also had this really interesting technique his lawyer told me about, which was to print somewhat less than what they knew. So if they ran a story saying a celebrity was cheating on his wife, they would perhaps decide not to have mentioned that the young woman was 15 years old. So they could say to somebody, you can bring a lawsuit if you'd like, but we're not only going to talk about what we've said on the stand in court, we're going to reveal this additional information.
Now, by the time Confidential was first published, the Hollywood studios had near total control of what was written about their stars and upcoming films. And along comes this gossip rag that threatens that total dominion over the message. How did they react?
Well, they were confused at first. They didn't quite know what to do. So they sent representatives to Harrison in New York and begged him to leave them alone. Harrison wasn't interested. Some of them offered to spend some money on advertising, but his magazine thrived from circulation revenue, the single copy sale. He didn't care about advertising. So he didn't need their money.
If Confidential magazine was a leader in this field, what killed it? You know, why isn't it still in the newsstands today?
What happened was Harrison had a big falling out with his editor-in-chief, Howard Rushmore. They realized that they were getting into some trouble, a few lawsuits, because Rushmore had not been doing the fact-checking that they had always relied so heavily on. So they fired him. He left. He quickly went to California to Pat Brown, the attorney general, and said, I'm happy to testify about what really goes on at Confidential. The resultant trial was the O.J. Simpson trial of its time, covered every day on the front page of the New York Times, on the front page of Le Monde, on the front page of the Times of London. And he destroyed the magazine by getting on the stand and revealing the names of all of the Confidential's confidential informants. The second issue was that Harrison, who above all was a family man, he was not in any danger in this trial. The charge was conspiracy to commit criminal libel because he was in New York. But his niece, she was in L.A., and she faced a possible prison term and a fine. So he finally decided to knuckle under. He entered an agreement to no longer publish Hollywood Scandal in the magazine. Its circulation fell from, I think, 4 or 5 million at the time to 250,000 in less than a year.
What is the brief, you know, five-year heyday of Confidential Magazine. Tell us about American society in the 50s, and does any of that still mean anything today?
Hollywood movies were the funhouse mirror in which Americans check their reflections. And they saw this really reassuring notion of who Americans really were. Reassuring, but absolutely false. And Confidential exposed all of that. And I would imagine Americans could all take a deep breath and go, especially those Americans who hadn't been living up to that code, but maybe naively imagined that the rest of the country did.
Well, Henry, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. I really enjoyed it.
Henry Scott is author of Shocking True Story, The Rise and Fall of Confidential, America's Most Scandalous Scandal Magazine.
Coming up, more Thanksgiving scandal and sleaze.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting this year's community health leaders, working to improve health in communities nationwide at communityhealthleaders.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back to the subject of scandal and the practices used to report it. Turns out the phone hacking by Rupert Murdoch's News of the World did not mark a new low for journalism. Arguably, that mark may have been hit in the summer of 1897, when the body parts of New York masseur William Goldensuppy began turning up all over the city, except his head. Eventually, the grisly crime was blamed on Goldensuppy's lover, Augusta Knack, and her lover, Martin Thorne. And that particular summer, William Randolph Hearst had launched a new evening edition of the New York Journal, and he was determined to trounce his main competition, Joseph Pulitzer's New York World, by owning the Goldensuppy murder. Last summer, I spoke with Paul Collins, author of The Murder of the Century, the Gilded Age crime that scandalized a city and sparked the tabloid wars.
Initially, the police were actually not inclined to pursue the case because they thought that they wouldn't be able to solve it. There was no crime scene. There was no clear identity on the body. And it was really the newspapers that solved it. They were the ones that started throwing reporters into it, having them scour the city to try to find who might be missing. The papers really very actively inserted themselves in the case in such a way that it almost certainly wouldn't have been solved without them.
But along the way, broke the law, violated any sense of professional ethics.
All the papers were covering the story, but the two that really went head-to-head and kind of defined it were Hearst's New York Journal and Joseph Pulitzer's New York World. Pulitzer had his people offer a reward to readers for any clues. They stole evidence from one of the crime scenes. When they found a likely murder scene, they actually gouged out a piece of the floorboard to have it tested for blood. One of their cub reporters, when he found the likely identity of the victim out, actually visited the house before the police did, talked to Mrs. Knack, one of the people in this love triangle. He was actually posing as a soap salesman and gave her a sample to try out in her kitchen. And while she was in the kitchen, he stole a photo off of her mantle that he figured was probably William Goldensuppy.
Oh my goodness. I'm sorry. I apologize. I left subterfuge and theft out of the list of criminality that I gave you before.
The World was pretty impressive in what it was willing to do, but Hearst actually managed to top them almost every step of the way. When they first got word of Mrs. Knack's apartment as being this likely crime scene, Hearst personally went over to the apartment. Her lease on the place had actually just run out. And he went to the landlord of the building and offered him an immense sum of money to lease out the crime scene, to lease out the apartment, and then proceeded to only allow Hearst reporters and police into the apartment. And he also had other staff go to all the local payphones to cut the cords. So then when they got to the scene, found they couldn't go in and went to a payphone to try to call their newsroom, they would just pick up these receivers and the cord would just be hanging.
But of course, Augusta Knack and Martin Thorne were arrested for conspiring to murder William Goldensuppy. And naturally, both Pulitzer and Hearst decided to let justice take its course, right?
No, it got worse. at that point, they were sending reporters constantly into the jail. And Mrs. Knack was trying to send a letter to Martin Thorne, who was in the same jail. She was using what was known as a trustee, actually another prisoner that the warden gave special privileges to because he was nonviolent and trusted, basically. Mrs. Knack gave him a letter hidden inside a sandwich and told him to take it to Martin Thorne. Instead, he waited till the warden sent him out on an errand outside the jail. He went straight to the Journal's newsroom and gave them this letter. They then copied the letter and allowed it then to go onwards to Martin Thorne, who destroyed it.
Hacked voicemails, 1897 style.
Yes. The attorney general was not amused.
So when did the yellow press actually turn into physical tabloids?
One thing I noticed when I was looking at the New York Journal was that by the turn of the century, it started to actually look different. The ratio of the paper had gone from 1.4 to 1.25 in just a few years. It actually was getting more and more square. And Hearst started using giant headlines for everything. At first, you would have 6-inch tall headlines for a war starting. But by the turn of the century, Hearst was using them for everything. You know, the building collapse, someone gets murdered in Union Square. Anything like that would have these giant screaming headlines. So although tabloids sort of proper really got fully underway in the 20s, even by the turn of the century, you could already see things moving in that direction.
Now, it clearly has evolved differently in the United States than it has in the UK. You could argue that the New York Post and the Daily News are kind of lowbrow and populistic, and they don't shy away from a big, colorful crime. But they're also not News of the World or the Daily Mail. What happened historically that the UK versions of tabloid sensationalism and the more muted US version diverged?
I think that there was a great deal of worry over Hearst's influence after the Spanish-American War. He kind of parlayed this power that he had into the support of the war to the point where he actually fought in a battle in Cuba. He also offered to pay for a regiment. Clearly, he was taking on a pretty disturbing role. One of the people, strangely enough, who seemed to be especially disturbed by this was Pulitzer, who, after trying to keep up with Hearst, actually started to back away from what he had helped create and helped fund the journalism school at Columbia, funded the Pulitzer Awards, of course, and so left a very different legacy. Hearst's influence really manifested itself much more with Lord Northcliffe in Britain, who was sort of an intermediary figure between Rupert Murdoch and Hearst. That influence has become much more manifest, I think, in Britain and in Murdoch's empire.
So you think that Rupert Murdoch is the kind of moral successor to William Randolph Hearst?
I think that they are very similar in many ways, one of which is that most biographers of Hearst didn't seem to regard him as immoral so much as amoral. He was just interested in selling newspapers and in extending his influence. And a lot of the strategies that Hearst did of turning news into a narrative, picking some stories and covering them nonstop, bringing in lots of talking heads to keep a story rolling, even when there's no new developments, is completely recognizable today.
Yeah, it's the Fox News Channel.
Yeah, they very much have inherited that Hearst tradition.
Paul, thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you.
Paul Collins is Associate Professor of English at Portland State University and author of The Murder of the Century, The Gilded Age Crime That Scandalized a City and Sparked the Tabloid Wars.
Kinky sex, religion, the beauty queen, Mormon missionaries, kidnap at gunpoint. There was something in that story for everyone. It was a perfect tabloid story.
In 1977, a young American Mormon missionary named Kirk Anderson, studying in England, vanished and resurfaced a few days later with a remarkable story. He said that Joyce McKinney, a former Miss Wyoming whom he dated, had followed him to London, kidnapped him at gunpoint, chloroformed him, imprisoned him in a cabin, and raped him. McKinney claimed that she and Anderson were in love, a love he had disavowed because of Mormon brainwashing. It was the perfect tabloid story, and the British tabs dove in, siding either with Kirk or with Joyce. Director Errol Morris, who had freed an innocent man on death row with his documentary The Thin Blue Line and probed the psyche of Robert McNamara in The Fog of War, has attempted to get to the bottom of the McKinney scandal in his latest documentary, Tabloid. When we spoke to him last summer, he told us that he interviewed McKinney at length and found her views unchanged after 33 years.
Do you think a woman can rape a man?
No. I think that's like putting a marshmallow in a parking meter. A guy either wants to have sex or he doesn't. He has an erection or he doesn't.
Morris doesn't ever solve the mystery of what happened in that cabin in Devonshire. Instead, he serves up a series of conflicting narratives tracing the events of those days long ago.
Someone said I should call it Rasha Mormon. I've resisted that.
So you haven't actually opted to get to the bottom of it, but simply to offer different layers of it.
I may not have gotten to the bottom of it, but I don't think it's quite fair to say that I haven't tried. In history, we depend on evidence, whether it's first-person accounts of what happened, documents, et cetera, et cetera. But what if pieces of evidence are just missing? What do you do? Now, this story concerns an alleged kidnapping and rape in a rented love cottage off the coast of England. Did Joyce McKinney rape her ex-boyfriend, Kirk Anderson? There were three people who were in that love cottage. Joyce McKinney's close friend, KJ, who died a number of years ago. Joyce and Kirk Anderson. Only one person has talked to me. Missing files, photographs. This was a big court case in England. You would think that there would be court records, police files that I could lay my hands on. A lot of stuff, for whatever reason, gone.
Why did you choose this story?
I don't know if I choose any of the stories that I've pursued. They choose me.
Oh, come on.
Okay, let's try it a second time. I'm a promiscuous reader. I saw an AP wire service story in the Boston Globe. Starts off with dog cloning. Bernan McKinney has cloned her beloved pit bull, Booger, and produced five mini boogers, as she describes them. I get to the bottom of the article, and there's a brief mention of the possibility that Bernan McKinney is Joyce McKinney. Joyce McKinney, the subject of a tabloid war in the late 70s in England. So it's that combination of A and B. Sex and chains, dog cloning.
What did you learn about tabloid journalism?
I feel deeply conflicted when I hear the word tabloid journalism because I love tabloid journalism. A lot of my stories really have come out of tabloid-like stories. Does tabloid journalism have to be bad journalism? Does it have to be destructive journalism? Does it have to be criminal journalism? I would argue no. The scandal that we're looking at today with News of the World, yes, the News of the World is a tabloid, but what they did goes so far beyond what would imagine any journalist doing. They have involved themselves in actual criminal behavior.
Fundamentally, what you're saying is that this whole News of the World scandal is giving tabloid journalism a bad name.
Well, it always had a bad name. It's giving it a worse name. Whatever journalism is, and I'm not altogether sure about what it is, but I do know one thing. On some level, it has to have a concern with the truth. In the movie that I just made, I'm left with the feeling that this tabloid war got completely out of hand.
Between the Express and the Mirror.
And the Sun. Let's not leave Murdoch completely out of this. One of the journalists, it's perhaps my favorite line in the movie, Peter Torre says at one point,
he was taken in and chained to, Joyce claims it was ropes, not chains, but chain sounds better. Anyway,
He was allegedly.
What is this telling us? It's telling us that there is this narrative pull, the need to sell newspapers, the need to come up with a good story versus what actually happened.
And if that's the case, you have said that the Joyce McKinney story has been told many thousands of times, the general shape of the story. You liken it to the Aeneid. And so give us those ultimate narrative elements that you see again and again that you explored in that.
Well, certainly the narrative of hopeless love that runs through this entire story. Joyce, in this amazing footage that I discovered, she had shot part of a film some 30 years ago. And she's narrating a fairy tale that she has written about herself.
Once upon a time, there was a little princess, the most beautiful little princess in all the land. But the little princess was unhappy, for she was lonely. Someday, she would find her kind, handsome prince, and he would sweep her up.
Everything that she imagined coming true has come true, as if she's followed some strange narrative script of her own devising. So many competing stories here. The tabloid war decided that they were going to play out the Joyce McKinney story in different ways. One paper decided that she was a virgin. The other paper, he decided she was a whore. No interest anymore in Joyce McKinney. She becomes fodder for competing narratives.
Biographers are sometimes subject to a kind of Stockholm syndrome where they, I won't say fall in love with their characters, but they get inside their character's skin. Do you find that that's a problem?
No. And yes, I would have to say that I embrace Stockholm syndrome. I'm getting myself into trouble, but why not? And here's why. We know there are endless styles of journalism, endless ways in which one person can interview another person. We're all familiar with the Mike Wallace school of interviewing. You try to trap the person interviewed into a set of contradictions. I look at what I do as being the exact opposite. I try to learn something about the person I'm interviewing. I try to capture them and how they see themselves in the world. I also can't really interview people that I don't like on some level. If I can't see myself in them, I can't do it. Now, maybe this makes me a bad journalist, but I truly believe it's at the heart of my art.
So how does it feel when Joyce McKinney runs around saying, "This is a travesty"?
Well, the phrase I'm particularly fond of, she called my movie tabloid a celluloid catastrophe. She is certainly entitled to her opinion. I believe that this is a truly loving portrait. Most people come away from this movie really liking her and identifying with her, even in some cases.
Well, you have a grudging admiration for her persistence, but she's definitely a fruitcake.
Haven't you ever been involved in some kind of obsessive love?
Well, if so, nothing that calls to mind what Joyce McKinney was involved in.
She may have taken it to a new kind of extreme, but I think we all, I can, recognize themselves in this story. What is the essence of a tabloid story? I think it's the thought, this could have happened to me, and I'm so glad it didn't.
Errol Morris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Errol Morris's latest documentary is Tabloid.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Dylan Keefe, Jamie York, Alex Goldman, BJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Gianna Palmer and Doug Anderson, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Happy Thanksgiving weekend.
Shop safely. I'm Bob Garfield.
Like walking in the rain and the snow when there's nowhere to go when you're feeling like...
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.